Okay. This is an interview with Grace Vogel for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas, and today's date is September 9th, 2013. So first off, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today. I think we'll just start with a little basic background, where you're from, what kind of familial background you had, what expectations you may have had for where you would go in your life, and your education, and that sort of thing.
I grew up in New York City, went to New York City public schools, went to college up at the State University of New York in Albany. I chose accounting as a major, thinking that it would be a good thing from a job perspective mm-hmm. to learn a trade. There would always be jobs for mm-hmm. accountants. As I was graduating from school, most of the accounting majors were going to the big four accounting firms. Mm-hmm. I actually had an interest in Wall Street, and therefore when I saw that the NASD was recruiting on campus mm-hmm. in Albany, I decided to apply for the position.
Okay. What did your parents do? I mean, was there anything in particular that led you in that direction? Or
No, my mother worked in real estate.
Okay.
And my father was a produce inspector.
Okay.
So
you didn't have any interest in going into securities or anything like that until you ended up in it with the NASD?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, I always had an interest in the markets and how the markets worked.
Okay.
But instead of being a finance or an economics major, I mm-hmm. chose the major of accounting.
Right.
Knowing that it was a more practical.
Right, right. Okay, so then what, tell me a little bit about getting in at NASD then. What was the job like? What was the interview process like, I suppose?
Well, the NASD ran a training program, so mm-hmm. Many individuals were recruited right out of college with a bachelor's degree in mm-hmm. either finance or accounting. There were several of us who graduated from the same class at Albany that mm-hmm. were hired at the same time and mm-hmm. were in the same training program.
Mm-hmm. I might have asked, was there anything in particular that brought you to SUNY Albany?
Well, I was interested in a state school for financial reasons.
Right.
My intention was to spend a little bit of time there and to transfer.
Oh, okay.
But I really made very good friends there,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of transferring wasn't as interesting
right.
to me after I had gotten comfortable there.
Established, yeah.
I chose Albany because it had a very good business school
mm-hmm.
at the time, and I'm actually still connected to the school. I serve on the board of a program we've established, working with John Malitzis in our Market Reg group. We've worked in establishing a program that offers a major and minor in financial market regulation. So the work that we do now to train individuals in our training program, much of the background that they need coming into that training program, they are actually getting in college,
mm-hmm.
which has worked well.
So I've interrupted us from the NASD then,
yeah.
So I'll let you continue on with that. They had a training program,
yeah.
you were saying.
They had a training program, and we were, you know, there were a number of us who came out of SUNY Albany. There were graduates from other schools as well, and we, at the time, spent 3 weeks down here in Washington in this building, actually, in
mm-hmm.
a class, then went back out into the field,
mm-hmm.
Did some on-the-job training,
mm-hmm.
and then came back, I believe it was 6 months later,
okay.
To do more classroom training.
Were you hired for a particular job, or did that come after the end of the training that you...
It was a particular
yeah.
job as an examiner.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about your duties then as an examiner?
We were responsible for visiting the member firms mm-hmm. and reviewing their books and records for compliance
okay.
with various SEC rules as well as NASD rules.
Okay. And what was the work environment there like? And this particular interview is, of course, for the upcoming Women Regulators Gallery, at least in part. And so we're interested, you know, in particular as your, in your experiences as a woman. So, but I mean it in both senses.
Mm-hmm. Well, there weren't very many women mm-hmm. in the job at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think there may have been... I would say less than a handful of
yeah.
women who were examiners
mm-hmm.
at the time. And I do remember going to a member firm, a small broker-dealer, and having the dialogue with the sole proprietor of that broker-dealer when mm-hmm. I asked for his bank statements and bank reconciliations.
Mm-hmm.
The response I got was, "My wife doesn't see this information, so why should I show it to you?"
See.
I'm pretty certain mm-hmm. if it was a male examiner on
right.
the other side of the table, it would have been a very different dialogue.
Mm-hmm. On the whole, how was the experience? Was it comfortable there, or was it, in general, a male-dominated environment?
It was certainly a male-dominated
right.
environment, but women were certainly made to feel welcome
right,
and comfortable.
Right, okay. I'm correct that you were only there for a couple of years before moving up to managing director of member firm regulation at
well,
NYSE?
Well, I actually started as a coordinator
okay,
at the
okay.
NYSE.
I thought it seemed like quite
mm-hmm,
the leap.
Yeah, yes. So I started as a finance coordinator at
mm-hmm.
the New York Stock Exchange. I moved over because it was a better opportunity to deal with larger firms.
Uh-huh.
And I was, I think, the second female coordinator hired
okay.
at the New York Stock Exchange. And I believe there were two female examiners
mm-hmm.
at the time at the New York Stock Exchange, both of whom were not allowed to travel
because mm-hmm.
that was a problem back. Now, this is early 80s.
Early 80s, even.
And it was a problem for the female examiners to travel with the men.
I see.
So, I don't remember at what point that changed.
Mm-hmm.
I guess as we started hiring more women,
mm-hmm.
the rules changed. But I do remember coming into the New York Stock Exchange and dealing with a lot of the large firms. And,
yes.
In the 80s, there were a number of crises
right.
in the industry. There was always something happening.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the job of the coordinator was to determine what was happening in the marketplace, what the impact of what was happening in the marketplace was to
mm-hmm.
the member firm from a financial and operational perspective.
Okay.
So and this was before we had computers where you could send a quick, you know, mass email to
mm-hmm.
say the market dropped a certain number of points or the Hunt Silver crisis occurred, what's the impact to the firm? So it was a phone conversation.
Right.
And I remember many of the larger firms pushing back in that they were not very comfortable and asked a lot of questions as to why am I asking and
mm-hmm.
really tried to deter the conversation. And I found that it was very important to be prepared.
Right.
So I was, you know, reading the Wall Street Journal from cover to cover every day to make sure I understood
mm-hmm.
What was happening in the marketplace and thought through the impact
mm-hmm.
of any of the events that were occurring and then anticipated the next question that I would get
mm-hmm.
from the person on the other end of the phone in order to be prepared as opposed to being intimidated
right.
by those questions coming back.
So when you're trying, what's the larger rationale for trying to establish the impact on firms? I ask the question because you say that there was also pushback, and so
mm-hmm.
I don't quite
yeah.
see why they would be pushing back if you're interested in their in the impact on them.
Right. So we were responsible for ensuring the financial soundness assessing the financial soundness of the firms and their operational capabilities. And there were often times when firms may have sustained a significant loss or there were problems that were encountered and they did not historically have a very upfront and comfortable relationship with the regulators because they were concerned about potential enforcement action.
Right. So I suppose they would be eager not to look vulnerable as well.
That's correct.
Yeah. Were there any mentor figures, either going all the way back to Albany or in your first couple of jobs with the NASD or the New York Stock Exchange, women or otherwise, or role models?
I didn't necessarily, I can't say I had any individual mentors, but I certainly worked for people over time or worked with people over time who I learned a lot from, and those individuals certainly shaped my career.
Okay.
For the most part, they were men, not women. But I learned, from a person that I worked for at J.P. Morgan to be very concise in asking questions, getting right to the point and making statements, being well prepared for meetings, always anticipating the next question and being prepared to respond to that question, thinking through the impact of various decisions.
So as a coordinator then, in assessing the impacts of say, market movements on firms, would that be a heavily quantitative sort of analysis where you'd draw heavily on your accounting background, or would it be more of a general qualitative sort of thing?
It was really a combination of both. Many times I would get a qualitative response, but I would often want to work through the T accounts to understand the quantitative impact.
Sure.
That was helpful because at times I wasn't getting the complete story. So being able to ask follow-up questions and to ask the firm to take a step back and walk me through journal entries or, walk me through how something specifically worked was helpful in really getting an understanding of the problem or the situation.
Okay. Did that cover your time? No, you actually did then move up to the managing director.
Yes, I was a coordinator, finance coordinator, senior finance coordinator, then a surveillance director.
Okay.
And then a managing director, which had responsibility for both the surveillance, which is the coordinator program, as well as the examiner program.
Okay.
One specific portion of it at NYSE.
So there were indeed pretty good opportunities for advancement then. You were right in moving over.
That's right. There were opportunities for advancement.
And you generally found those to be open, going back to the gender question.
Yes. I actually question, looking back in hindsight, whether or not being a woman was favorable.
Oh, yes.
At the time, since there were so few women. I think over the years there has been a push to recognize women and to promote women to the extent that they are competent.
You feel that there were people, that was beginning at that time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Who are some of the people around you, especially that you worked for before you moved into the management, the managing director position?
I worked for someone by the name of John Fazio, Peter Kowalewski. This was all under Bob Bishop.
Okay.
And then Dave Marcus, Ed Qualwasser.
Okay.
All of the New York Stock Exchange at the time.
Okay. So tell me a little bit then, when did you become managing director of Member Firm Regulation?
That was...
I mean, we don't need to be precise, but... You were there from 79 to 93.
Yeah. So maybe 85.
85? Okay. Mm-hmm. So then tell me a little bit more about that role then.
That was a managerial role.
Mm-hmm.
Not the first, because as a surveillance director,
right.
I had a managerial role also, but with a much smaller team.
Okay.
So that was the first managerial role that I had with a larger team.
Right.
My experience has shown that people get promoted because of their technical expertise,
mm-hmm.
and then you need... No one necessarily trains you to be a manager.
Yeah.
You kind of learn to be a manager on mm-hmm. the job.
Right.
That was a challenging role because of the technical expertise that was needed, but also because of the managerial capability.
How was your own transition into that role? Did you find it natural, or was it more of a learning process?
I found that it was absolutely a learning process.
Yeah.
I enjoyed doing it,
mm-hmm.
Although... I always found that it was much easier to solve the technical problems
mm-hmm.
than to solve the human resource problems.
Right.
And as I look back on my career, the problems that have kept me awake the longest at night
mm-hmm.
were the people problems
right.
as opposed to the technical problems.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the technical problems were generally... easier to solve
sure.
and less heart-wrenching.
Well, was it a fractious problem. Environment, or was it more harmonious, I guess?
It was a harmonious environment,
mm-hmm.
but there are always issues when
right.
it comes to people.
Right.
So, I think it's important. I've always felt that I want the people who work for me to enjoy the work that they do and the people that they work with, given
mm-hmm.
that we all spend
right.
a lot more time in the office than we do with our families and our friends. And I always try to build camaraderie
right.
across the teams and to strive for the team to work well together.
Mm-hmm. And so... Obviously, the late 1980s is a very... I mean, you have, of course, the crash in 87
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. Could you tell me, were you deeply involved in trying to respond to that? I mean, I would
mm-hmm.
suppose so.
Yes. I actually
yeah.
remember. I remember exactly where I was because I was
mm-hmm.
speaking at the SIA, the Securities Industry Association at the time, the Internal Audit Division had
mm-hmm.
a conference in Florida, and I was speaking at that conference when the market took a turn.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, commandeering the staff and
mm-hmm.
trying to assess the damages
mm-hmm.
upon the firms.
Right.
And it was certainly a challenging period of time.
Was there a response with new rules then, early on at that level?
Coming out of the market break from the standpoint of financial and operational rules, I don't believe
no. Okay.
that there were. There may have been marketplace, like the circuit breaker
mm-hmm.
rules may have resulted from that market break. But from a financial standpoint,
right?
I don't recall there being any changes to the rules, to either NYSE rules at the time or
right.
SEC rules.
Right. Could you clarify me? Are you in a rulemaking position then in this position, or is it more just I guess, enforcement
of the rules? We informed. It was examination and surveillance.
Okay.
And we informed policymaking.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And did you have a lot of contact with, say, the SEC in that position?
Yes.
Okay.
We had probably daily contact with the SEC, with, I guess it was the predecessor to Trading and Markets at the time. So we would share information. Since the NYSE had coordinators assigned to each of the member firms, we were able to get information from the firms on the impact of the market break, and we would share that information with the SEC.
Okay. Now, when you say you had a coordinator, I assume that each coordinator has a number of member firms.
Yes, obviously. Yep.
Otherwise,
yep.
That'd be a lot of coordinators. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, we had a lot of member firms in those days. The numbers have dwindled significantly over the years.
So what would you regard, then, as the most pressing issues that you dealt with over the course of your time in that job?
Well, I was at the New York Stock Exchange during the junk bond crisis at Drexel and the indictment of Michael Milken, and then the liquidation of Drexel Burnham Lambert as a New York Stock Exchange member firm. So that was certainly challenging. We worked very closely with the SEC on that. Mike Macchiaroli, who's in Trading and Markets at the SEC, spent quite a bit of time in my office in New York. We visited the firm several times a week, and we're continuously getting updates from them with respect to the transfer of customer accounts and the liquidation of firm assets.
Okay.
So that's going back to 1990.
Okay. So, I mean, is there anything else that we should cover before we move to J.P. Morgan, or do you think that we get a general idea?
I think that may cover highlights.
All right. Well, then why don't we discuss the circumstances then that brought you to J.P. Morgan? That was as chief accounting officer, is that correct?
Well, I started at J.P. Morgan as the head of the regulatory reporting group in the broker-dealer.
Okay.
So over the years when I was at the New York Stock Exchange, I had been approached many times about jobs in the industry, and I'd always said that I wasn't interested. I think I had gotten to the point where I felt that I had learned a lot at the NYSE and was getting a little bored. And when J.P. Morgan approached me, it was an inflection point to say, well, I could spend the rest of my career at the New York Stock Exchange, or I could take advantage of an opportunity at a first-class firm.
Right.
These opportunities don't come along that often. So I made the decision to leave the New York Stock Exchange and join Morgan.
Now, I know self-regulating organizations, you know, tend to be sort of regarded as a midway point pay-wise between, say, the SEC and the private firm. I mean, I assume that, you know, that was a fairly healthy payday, if you don't mind me saying.
There was a significant increase.
Right.
But I really moved to expand my skill set, you know, to see how business was really done, to really learn more about what went on inside a firm.
Right.
And as I look back now and reflect, I think I make a much better regulator, having worked at the firm and two firms, and I think that it would be great for every regulator to have spent some time at a member firm to understand how things are done and to see what really happens in real life, to have a sense as to, you know, what goes on. Gives you a very different perspective.
Right. That was going to be my next question. So you were approached by J.P. Morgan then to come into this position.
And so
the culture, I assume, obviously the work is different. The culture, I assume, is also very different.
The culture was very different. I actually loved J.P. Morgan as an organization. Huge collection of very bright people, and the teamwork was exemplary. It was, the culture was all around, you know, we, how do we succeed as an organization, as opposed to how do I get ahead? Very, very team-oriented. Individuals were compensated based upon their teamwork. It was really a priority. And very, very smart people wanting to do the right thing. The motto of first-class business in a first-class way. Certainly saw it every day.
Were you brought in specifically to, I guess, assist in compliance, would it be, or just for your skills in general?
The organization at the time was transforming from a commercial bank to an investment bank. Their business had been, you know, primarily lending to investment-grade companies. And as the capital markets changed and investment-grade companies were able to access the capital markets themselves, they really didn't need J.P. Morgan. So Morgan was transforming from a commercial bank to an investment bank, and they were looking for someone with the regulatory expertise on the financial side.
I see.
Financial and operational side, which is why I was brought in. J.P. Morgan historically hired individuals right out of school. I was known as a mid-career hire because I came with 15 years of experience. I was brought into the broker-dealer, J.P. Morgan Securities, Inc., at the time, to head up the regulatory reporting group, which was part of the financial organization.
And versus the New York Stock Exchange, would there be, say, more women or less or about the same as?
There were a lot more women.
At J.P. Morgan?
At J.P. Morgan.
Okay,
yeah.
That's
I
interesting.
Think, Morgan was really ahead of the times in terms of its recognition of women. The person that I worked for was a woman.
Who was that?
Debbie Cuney.
Okay.
The general counsel of the broker-dealer was a woman. The treasurer of the broker-dealer was a woman. So there were a lot of women in senior positions.
Okay, so I gather a very comfortable environment then, too. Okay. So I have it that you were both chief accounting officer and chief financial officer. You went from the first, the accounting to financial.
Yeah, I was the head of regulatory reporting at the broker-dealer. Then I picked up bank regulatory reporting. And then I became the chief financial officer of the broker-dealer and had the bank regulatory reporting. And then several years later, expanded my responsibility to include the monthly closing process, the public reporting side, the accounting policy side. That was the chief accounting officer role.
Now, of course, accounting is having kind of an interesting history in the 1990s. Of course, in some companies, they have the aggressive company accounting, like in Enron, for example, that ultimately explodes. Were you witness to that in some way in that role? Like, could you see changes in accounting standards taking place either at the firm or beyond it?
Well, there were a couple of different a couple of different ways I can answer that. We had a group. We had front office individuals who worked with public companies, public and private companies, to help them structure transactions, sometimes to get certain accounting treatment. So I was involved in many discussions with business people about whether or not certain structures would should be treated on or off balance sheet. And then from J.P. Morgan's own accounting side, there was a lot going on during that time period. There were questions at the time with respect to the bank's allowance for loan losses. It was, I guess, a very benign credit environment for many years, and Morgan had built up accounting reserves as a result of the emerging markets LDC crisis. And we were one of the banks that were questioned by the SEC with respect to the size of the allowance for loan losses and whether or not it was appropriate to maintain such large reserves. So those are, you know, two ways in which I got involved in some of these discussions and what's going on.
And, of course, this is, if I understand properly, the period when, say, the derivatives market begins to expand as well. And I know that presents certain accounting challenges, which we later learned about rather dramatically. How about on that end?
I mean, J.P. Morgan was cutting edge in terms of being a derivatives house. Structured derivative transactions for their clients as well as for their own balance sheet. And we worked very closely with the Fed with respect to capital treatment of transactions for our own account, and had an advisory role with respect to the treatment of certain transactions on behalf of clients. So it was an interesting time, very cutting edge, very, very interesting. I remember having many conversations with our partners at Price Waterhouse, asking them for guidance, and it was there was never a textbook answer that could be given to us.
I mean, do you have to deal in your position in depth with like more technical elements to it? I mean, I know that there are a lot of you know, advanced mathematics to the calculation of risks on derivatives and that sort of thing.
Members of my staff and members of the risk team got more involved in the calculations.
Okay, so you had a large staff of quants, so to speak.
We had quants within J.P. Morgan that did not report to me. But yes, because many of the reserves were based upon, and some of the pieces of the risk-based capital were derived from models. We used value-at-risk models and other models to compute our regulatory capital. And models were also used in some instances to determine the level of reserves that would be maintained.
Should we move on to Citibank then?
Sure.
All right. So you make the move. How does that come about?
I was at J.P. Morgan at the time of the merger with Chase. And I guess about a week or so after the merger was announced, I got a call from the controller of Citibank asking me to get together with him. I actually worked with him on a number of different committees. There was a New York Clearinghouse Financial Reporting Committee, and there was a group that the controllers of the top 25 banks in the country had an ad hoc group called COBAR, Committee on Bank Accounting and Reporting. They got together a couple times a year to discuss common issues. So I had had some interaction with the controller of Citibank, and I guess he used the merger of J.P. Morgan and Chase as an opportunity to see if I'd be interested in moving over to Citi.
And evidently you were.
And I was, yes. Mm-hmm. I think the culture of Chase was very different than the J.P. Morgan culture.
Could you tell me a little bit about that?
J.P. Morgan, I thought, did a very good job of moving people into different roles.
Mm-hmm.
So you would do a job for a few years, and then your job would be expanded, mm-hmm. or you would do something completely different.
It was really satisfying your initial motivation for going there, which was to expand your horizons.
Yes, and I think J.P. Morgan's philosophy, mm-hmm. from a people perspective, was that if we hire bright people, mm-hmm. they can do anything.
Right.
And they don't necessarily need to be experts in a certain area. They mm-hmm. bring a different perspective mm-hmm. and can add value mm-hmm. to whatever role they take on. I think Chase's philosophy was a bit different, mm-hmm. probably because it was an organization that, unlike J.P. Morgan, that grew organically.
Mm-hmm.
Chase grew through mergers. So every few years, there was another merger with Chemical Bank and mm-hmm. Manufacturers Hanover and Texas Bank of Commerce. Chase represented an amalgam of different organizations, different banks. And I think that individuals in the organization felt comfortable being an expert in what they knew
mm-hmm.
because they felt that the longer they sat in their chair, the more likely when there was the next merger,
mm-hmm.
they would have a job.
Mm-hmm.
So very different cultures. And the idea of moving to Citi to take on a different role was something that interested me at the time.
Okay, so tell me about your arrival then. Came in as deputy controller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an interesting time.
Yeah, this is in 2001, February 2001.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with the end of the dot-com bubble here, I suppose.
Right. The end of the dot-com bubble dealt with the crisis in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
The Citigroup Global Markets and Enron and WorldCom.
Of course.
So there was no rest for the weary.
Yeah.
It was a busy time. A lot going on.
I'll imagine.
At the same time, we were putting in a new accounting system. So
okay.
That was part of the responsibility that I had, working to put in a new consolidation system.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about your team then? I assume mm-hmm. you're managing over quite a bit of personnel here.
Yeah. It was a couple of different groups of people that had responsibility for the consolidated closing process, mm-hmm. the public reporting, mm-hmm. so the earnings release, the 10Q, the 10K, and then the regulatory reporting.
Mm-hmm.
It was also, Citi was a much more global organization than mm-hmm. J.P. Morgan in terms of its presence around mm-hmm. the globe. So I felt that there was always someone working.
Mm-hmm.
The TV commercial says the city never sleeps.
Very true.
And the city never slept between, Asia and Europe and Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
There was always something going on.
And I imagine you have a lot of different people who are dealing with a lot of different systems, too, so you have to coordinate that in some way, I suppose.
Yeah, we had a lot of conference calls
yes.
at all hours of the day and night. And Citi's business was a lot broader because J.P. Morgan at the time didn't have a retail business.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was at Citi, I really got to learn about the retail banking
mm-hmm.
part of the business, which was all new to me,
mm-hmm.
and I found that interesting.
You found it similar to the J.P. Morgan culture insofar as being able to get involved? I mean, I suppose at that position you have to mm-hmm. be involved in pretty much everything. But
yeah. The culture was a bit different than the J.P. Morgan culture because Citi also did a lot of acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of different cultures
mm-hmm.
That had been merged together. It was, you know, very bright people, though, and very dynamic organization, very strong leader under Sandy Weill at mm-hmm. the time. I worked with a very small group of people in the corporate office. And there was, Todd Thompson was the CFO at the time, and there mm-hmm. was a small group of people, which included our investor relations group, and there was a lot of camaraderie mm-hmm. across the team, and it was a close-knit group, and mm-hmm. I think despite hard work, we had a good time.
Yeah. Were some of the vulnerabilities that would later strike after you left evident at that time, or in the aftermath of 2008, I mean, mm-hmm. of course?
When I was immediately prior to my being hired at mm-hmm. Citigroup, Citi had acquired a company called Associates, which was one of the largest subprime lenders mm-hmm. in the country. So I think from a vulnerability standpoint,
mm-hmm.
There was concern mm-hmm. that should the economy turn,
right.
the losses could increase.
Right.
There was no question.
Of course, when you left in 2004,
mm-hmm.
and so the housing bubble at that time was just in its initial stage. Ongoing.
Yeah.
Right. So this is also, I guess, where you would have met Richard Ketchum's acquaintance?
Yes. I actually, though, knew Rick from his days at the SEC.
Okay.
So when I was at the New York Stock Exchange and had worked on the liquidation of Drexel,
mm-hmm.
as well as, you know, some other things that had come up during my tenure at the New York Stock Exchange, I did have the occasion to speak to and meet with Rick.
Okay.
From time to time.
What was his position at the time?
He was the director of, I guess it was markets.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember the predecessor name to trading and markets.
Right.
But he was the director of markets. So it was, my primary contact was Mike Macchiaroli, who had responsibility for broker-dealer financial responsibility rules.
Mm-hmm.
Mike reported to Bob Colby. And then I think Mark Fitterman was in the mix there for a period mm-hmm. of time, and they reported to Rick Ketchum, who ran the division.
Right. And then he came to Citi in 2003.
He came to Citi.
I think. I have it written down, but not on anything with me. We don't need to get the precise date. But I believe he was only there about a year.
He was only there for 9 months,
yeah.
actually. So, yeah, I think you're right. He did come in 2003.
Okay.
And he left in March of 2004, I believe.
Right. And so this is part of very large moves back at the New York Stock Exchange, of which you were a part.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we, mm-hmm. unless there's anything more at Citi that we want to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I actually had occasion to see Rick again at Citi.
Right.
He was general counsel of the Corporate and Investment Bank. I think there were a couple of items that we were working on where our paths crossed. And then in the spring of 2007,
mm-hmm.
The senior ranks at the New York Stock Exchange were changing. This is after the Grasso.
You mean 2004?
2004, yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, 2004. This is when Grasso
right.
Left the exchange
mm-hmm.
And a number of other senior level positions turned over.
Right.
And Rick came in as the chief regulatory officer
right.
of the New York and was looking to fill positions, head of member regulation, mm-hmm. and the head of enforcement
right.
at the time. And he called me to ask me if I'd be interested in mm-hmm. returning to the New York Stock Exchange. And a couple of times I told him no. And then he said, well, let's get together for breakfast. I just want to get your thoughts mm-hmm. on the position and what you would do and maybe get some names from you as to mm-hmm. other people. So we got together, and the job that I said I wasn't interested in sounded a lot more interesting after we had a face-to-face meeting.
What was the pitch?
I think Rick's views and my views of regulation and how the place that member firm regulation should fill, mm-hmm. the philosophy about regulation mm-hmm. were very much aligned.
Okay. Could you, I guess, elaborate on that particular philosophy?
You could. I think, the philosophy of partnering with the firms mm-hmm. to educate them, mm-hmm. to help them do the right thing, mm-hmm. as opposed to catch them on the back end
right.
and take disciplinary action.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt that it was better to spend the time up front
right.
in trying to avoid the mishaps mm-hmm. rather than coming in at the back end to clean up a mess.
Well, of course, this is in some ways what you're doing when you arrive. I mean, you mentioned Dick Grasso, and there's
yeah.
also the issues over the analyst-broker relationships, mm-hmm. I believe the specialist front-running
yeah.
Issue at the time. Could you talk a little bit about the situation when you arrived, what mm-hmm. The priorities were? Mm-hmm. I assume there was a sense of mission arriving as part of Rick Ketchum's new team.
There was... There was a lot of work to be done mm-hmm. in terms of rulemaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that a lot of that rulemaking results from mm-hmm. violative conduct,
yeah.
and we resort to developing very specific rules to prevent that conduct in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But we were working on new supervisory rules at the time I arrived. I think they had just been adopted,
mm-hmm.
and this annual CEO certification that resulted from problems of a broker, his name is Gruta Doria, who mm-hmm. had been in a supervisory role. So those rules, which were not very well liked by the industry,
mm-hmm.
were being rolled out at the time. It required firms to have a chief compliance officer that did a review of
mm-hmm.
All of the controls and asserted to the had the CEO assert to the reasonableness of the controls
mm-hmm.
at the broker dealer. We had the research scandal, which required us to write specific rules on
mm-hmm.
Research and develop an examination, a certification for research analysts.
Mm-hmm. Now, I should have brought up Sarbanes-Oxley when we were still at Citi, but I assume mm-hmm. that's obviously quite relevant here as well. I mean, maybe you could talk about that in both locations and whether
mm-hmm.
there was an attitudinal difference
mm-hmm.
Between the two environments.
Yeah. The Sarbanes-Oxley requirements at Citigroup were not as transformational as one might think,
mm-hmm.
because as a bank, Citibank had a responsibility under FIDICIA,
mm-hmm.
which is the FDIC. Say something act.
Right.
I can't remember. I can't remember now what fiducia stands for, but I'll have to go back and research that. drawing a blank. So Citigroup always had a responsibility under fiducia to document controls and to conduct testing with respect to controls. And even though it was only technically the bank that was responsible for it, it had been rolled out, for the most part, company-wide. So the adoption of Sarbanes-Oxley was not as significant as it was for public companies that were not banks. The New York Stock Exchange rule on CEO certification and the review of control compliance controls was known by some as the Sarbanes-Oxley of compliance because the rules were very similar in terms of documenting policies and procedures and conducting testing to determine whether or not those policies and procedures were operating effectively.
Okay.
So I think the my joining the New York Stock Exchange, rejoining the New York Stock Exchange, was interesting because the organization had been around for 200 and some odd, maybe 212 years, maybe a little more than that. And it hadn't really changed, right? So it was a membership organization, and it had grown over the years, moving from the Buttonwood tree into a physical location on Wall Street. But for the most part, it was the New York Stock Exchange and wasn't very significantly different year over year. I joined in 2004, and then in 2005, there was the merger with Archipelago. And the New York Stock Exchange became a public company, which was a dramatic change from the standpoint of regulation. Because there was a lot of concern by the industry of having, and rightfully so, of having a regulator that was owned by a public company. So New York Stock Exchange set up a set up member regulation as a separate not-for-profit subsidiary under the New York Stock Exchange. Then in 2007, there was the merger with Euronext, which was certainly interesting, also becoming now an international company. So I think there were a lot of challenges raised by the New York Stock Exchange becoming public and having the regulatory group as a subsidiary. Which is likely what precipitated the one of the events that precipitated the merger with the NASD to form FINRA.
So I guess take me inside a little bit of NYSE regulation. And first of all, let's talk about the relationship with the stock exchange as a whole. But also I want to talk about the team that was there with you and I guess your perceptions of it.
We had a Rick was able to, you know, form his own team, and it was a very close-knit group that worked very well together. Susan Merrill, who was the head of enforcement, and I joined at about the same time. Robert Marchman was heading up market surveillance.
And he was already there, right?
He was already there. He had been in enforcement for a number of years. And had just recently moved over to head up the market regulation group.
What was your position in relation to his position?
We were of the same, equal. So I had responsibility for member regulation. He had responsibility for market regulation.
Oh, I see.
So we have the tag for FINRA is investor protection, market integrity. So I look at market surveillance as primarily responsible for market integrity, whereas we're responsible. Member regulation is responsible for investor protection, but we both cross. We just have primary and secondary.
Okay. And what was your position's relationship to the position that you had when you left way back in 1993? You were managing director at the time. Now you're executive vice president.
So I now had responsibility for the entire group of, of member regulation.
Okay, so let's see here. So John Melitzis also came over from Citi.
And then
I get, just to kind of fill out the the team, I know, I guess on the NASD side, there's Mary Shapiro and Elise Walter, who later come in through FINRA, is that correct?
They were at the NASD.
Right. Was there a lot of communication across that? Because it just seems to me that there, when you see kind of some of the same names pop up, especially after 2007, it makes you wonder about the personal professional connections before that.
Yeah. Well, Mary worked for Rick years ago.
Right.
A number of Mary staff at the NASD had followed her from the CFTC. There was a very close-knit group of individuals that worked together. The because of all the new regulations on the research side, resulting from the scandals, so the IPO scandals, the research scandals, there was a lot of regulation that NYSE was working on and NASD was working on, and the industry was really drowning, trying to keep up with the pace of regulation. And whereas we tried to coordinate as much as possible and harmonize as much as possible, there were times that there were nuances or real differences in the rules. The New York Stock Exchange primarily had the responsibility for the larger firms and had a much smaller base of membership, whereas the NASD had several thousand firms that varied in size dramatically. So there were a number of the rules that were promulgated by the NASD were geared to their diverse set of members, whereas NYSE generally had to worry only about larger firms. So there were some disparities in the rules. And the industry was clamoring for harmonization. So in the 2005, 2006, 2007 time frame, there was a lot of coordination that went on between NASD and NYSE on the rulemaking side. There was also a lot more collaboration on the examination side and sharing of information. The New York Stock Exchange was the designated examining authority for almost all of its members, which meant that the financial and operational program responsibility for compliance with the financial and operational rules was the responsibility of the NYSE, and the NASD examiner's domain was the sales practice rules. But NYSE also had a sales practice rule, a role in sales practices, and had a rule book that had many sales practice rules. And we did as best we could to coordinate with the NASD so mm-hmm. that we were not looking at the same thing
right.
At each firm.
And the relationship with the member firms, you said earlier, was tense in this period? I would suppose
it,
so.
It was. Yeah. And the member firms were, you know, clamoring for more coordination
mm-hmm.
So that we were not duplicating
mm-hmm.
what the other regulator was doing.
Okay. If I could come back just to revisit the women regulator theme, were you at all conscious of those sorts of issues at this point, or did it just seem like it wasn't really something there? I mean, you're in a group of powerful women.
Mm-hmm.
Did it occur to you?
No, I think by this point,
It was just all professional.
Women were as equal as men.
Yeah.
And a lot of the issues that had been faced earlier on were no longer existent.
Right, right. Okay, so you're responding to the scandals of the early 2000s and the new rulemaking, but you also have a number of changes that you have to keep up with in the market that are novel as well.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking a little bit about derivatives earlier. There's also, mm-hmm. of course, electronic trading, high-frequency trading. And then if you look up your name in the Wall Street Journal, you also have a host of, you know, more piecemeal issues like cash sweeps come up, client mm-hmm. spending. Could you tell me a little bit about kind of keeping the process, the internal process of keeping up with what's going on in the market?
Mm-hmm.
And with member firms.
I think that the challenge of every regulator
mm-hmm.
is to keep pace with the membership and the activities of the broker-dealers,
mm-hmm.
and it truly is a challenge. It's we always end up several paces behind. The question is what mm-hmm. that distance is. You know, having the coordinator program, both NYSE and NASD, started a ahead of the curve or emerging regulatory issues mm-hmm. groups to try to stay on top of new products
mm-hmm.
and new practices at firms
mm-hmm.
in order to identify issues that started cropping up before they became problems.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, through various intelligence, either having ongoing regular meetings with firms
mm-hmm.
to understand changes to their business, new products, you know, reading newspaper articles, just talking to people, being an investor yourself,
mm-hmm.
We try to identify. And we continue to try to identify practices that
mm-hmm.
could be troublesome
mm-hmm.
and look at them to determine what could go wrong and what controls should a firm have in place
mm-hmm.
to try to mitigate problems
right.
in the area.
So
and sometimes we can do it by issuing... Sometimes mm-hmm. we'll do a thematic sweep of firms from
mm-hmm.
an examination standpoint, to look at an area and identify what they're doing and try to come up with best practices that we can then give back to the member firms to say, this is something we identified as a potential problem. These
mm-hmm.
are strong practices that we observed, that we recommend if you don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't adopted them, that you should consider adopting.
So if we're talking about a specific case, like, say, the cash sweeps issue, which
mm-hmm.
I understand is where... a firm would put an investor into rather low yield
bank deposits
yeah.
Yeah,
rather than
mm-hmm.
Something more favorable to them.
Mm-hmm.
How would something like that unfold?
Well, we noticed a change in the industry, and the change was the change came about as more of the broker-dealers became affiliated with banks.
Mm-hmm.
So if I go back to the beginning of my career,
mm-hmm.
There were very few broker-dealers that had... We had a lot more broker-dealers.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a huge consolidation in the industry. But there were a lot fewer broker-dealers that had affiliated banks.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was in the 2000s that it became.
Well, that's what's associated with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, am I correct?
Or yeah, to some extent.
Okay.
To some extent. There was, I think because banks, and in fact I was at J.P. Morgan at the time.
Right.
Dealing with what was called Section 20, which limited the amount of revenue that mm-hmm. the broker-dealer could earn from ineligible sources, mm-hmm. which were, securities-type activity. But there were there was the ability to have affiliated banks as long as they weren't doing underwriting business or trading in ineligible securities.
Mm-hmm.
I guess through the 2000s, it became fashionable for every bank to have almost every bank to have a broker dealer, and whereas back in I guess the 1980s, it must be, was my guess, Merrill Lynch set up the CMA account and mm-hmm. had a sweep where customers' free credit balances, excess cash, pending reinvestment would be swept to a money market fund so it didn't sit there idly.
Mm-hmm.
The broker-dealers in the 2000s, now that they had an affiliated bank, identified the opportunity to sweep to a bank deposit as opposed to a money market fund that mm-hmm. in many instances was unaffiliated
right.
with the broker-dealer. So it was, let's keep the assets in our same
right.
corporate structure.
Does that come up to your attention through complaints at first then, or is it something that you detect through other means?
I think through the examination program and through ongoing dialogue with the member firms.
Okay.
And, through individuals on staff having accounts mm-hmm. at brokerage firms
right.
and noticing the change in practice. So we did a review of practices and identified some issues at the firms relative to disclosure
mm-hmm.
that could have been better. We had concern relative to those sweeps into banks that exceeded the FDIC protection
mm-hmm.
and how good the disclosure was to the customers at the time. And we also wanted customers to understand how much they were earning on those deposits and what they could have earned had their money stayed in the mutual fund mm-hmm. or been invested in another product.
Right. Why don't we talk a little bit about electronic trading and the rise of, the e-world, as it were,
mm-hmm.
In general. I mean, I know that it's really in this period when it becomes a real pressing issue from mm-hmm. a regulatory standpoint. Is that correct?
Yes. And continues to be
yes.
a pressing issue today. I don't think we have any answers. Much of the work that FINRA does mm-hmm. in the electronic trading, with respect to electronic trading, those reviews are conducted by our market regulation group.
Mm-hmm.
Where member regulation gets involved is looking at cybersecurity
mm-hmm.
and the potential for loss as a result of pump and dump schemes.
Mm-hmm.
An individual going into an account, a customer account, intruding into a customer's account and selling high quality stocks and investing in penny stocks
mm-hmm.
and pumping the price of those penny stocks up and then selling them
mm-hmm.
At a high. And we are very concerned about assets, customer assets, being removed from their account
mm-hmm.
because of hackers
right,
who
right.
are who are accessing the accounts.
I mean, I even ran across an old interview with you from 2005 where email retention was even a major question.
Email above retention and beyond. Is a challenge
mm-hmm.
for firms. We actually, at the New York Stock Exchange, we had put together a group to mm-hmm. look at the supervision of electronic communications
mm-hmm.
Because it was challenging. For firms, I mean, member firms have an obligation to supervise mm-hmm. what their employees are doing.
Right.
And when it was, you know, everything was documented in a letter,
mm-hmm.
it was much easier
right.
to supervise. Then came faxes, which were, as long as you had control over who was using the fax machine
mm-hmm.
and you kept the copies, that was easy. Then we went to emails.
Mm-hmm.
Then
people have private email accounts and that sort of thing.
Private email accounts were a problem. Then initially the social networking sites were closed and
right.
people were not allowed to use Facebook or LinkedIn
mm-hmm.
for business purposes. Now that's changed at
mm-hmm.
many firms. You've got reps who are out there on Twitter.
Yeah, I reckon smartphones as well.
So, yeah, electronic communications has changed so dramatically
yeah.
over the last 5 years, and it really is a challenge for firms to be able to supervise those communications.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that are, I guess, brewing right now in that respect, as far as the regulatory side of
mm-hmm.
things is concerned?
Yeah. We continue to look at liquidity and leverage
mm-hmm.
for the larger internationally active firms. We have concerns about outsourcing. We had
mm-hmm.
proposed a rule several years ago, and we are making some modifications.
Are we still talking about the electronic communications, or are we just...
No.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Okay.
Oh.
I was kind of
okay.
referring to that.
Oh, to electronic communications.
Yeah.
I think on the electronic communications front, firms generally find a vendor who
mm-hmm.
are able to retain
right.
all of the communications. If you can't retain it, then you can't use it
right.
for business purposes. But finding a vendor who can properly retain
mm-hmm.
all the tweets
mm-hmm.
and all of the entries to Facebook
mm-hmm.
or any, and then being able to search the data
mm-hmm.
in order to review it from a supervision
yeah, yeah.
standpoint is a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, out of the time I know, when I mentioned in 2005 you were talking about issues with Morgan Stanley, I think it was actually a couple years later that they were being quite evasive about
mm-hmm.
the availability of their email records, saying that they had been destroyed in the September 11th
mm-hmm.
attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but mm-hmm. but that in fact that was not true. I mean, I guess.
I don't remember the specific facts related
okay.
to that.
All right.
I do believe there was an enforcement action against the firm, so
mm-hmm.
it
right.
should be in the public record.
No,
I don't remember the details. But we continue to have firms
mm-hmm.
that have problems
yeah.
retaining
yeah.
records, not necessarily because they intended
mm-hmm.
to violate the record keeping rules, but
mm-hmm.
because their vendor was inept
mm-hmm.
or they didn't choose to pay for
mm-hmm.
a complete service, and there was a breakdown in communication as to what they thought they were getting and what they actually got.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. All right, so you were mentioning leverage a couple questions
yeah.
ago. So, of course,
yeah.
this brings us up to the big topic of
mm-hmm.
the financial crisis and
mm-hmm.
the aftermath of that. Actually, it wasn't... The roots of that, of course, were not incredibly visible before that. I mean, I actually found a reference where you were saying that the leverage was adequate sometime in early 2007, I believe. And then, of course, in 2008, it's clear that that was not true. Can you take me through, I guess, it must have been a shock from your position, the crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the markets were functioning effectively until all of a sudden, and I think it was a very short period of time, that the markets ceased to function. And when we looked at the size of the balance sheets and the leverage of firms, we did not have an appreciation for how much of the securitization activity flowed through the pipes on a regular basis and never hit the balance sheet of the firms. So while the sausage is being made, it's moving along, and the securitizations are happening, and the broker-dealer doesn't have to reflect any of that on their books and records. It was, as a result, you know, of the crisis, the credit markets dried up completely, and securitizations that were in process ended up on the books of the broker-dealers. And also, there were securities where the broker-dealer was the underwriter or the market maker, and they didn't necessarily have a contractual obligation to repurchase the securities, but because they wanted to retain a relationship with the customers, they made a decision to repurchase the securities and hold them on their balance sheet. There was also a presumption in the SEC's capital rule that stood up pretty well until the credit crisis, that if a debt security had two investment grade ratings, that there was a presumption of marketability and therefore liquidity. So investors would always be there to purchase investment grade securities. I think that we were very surprised. I was very surprised. After Lehman imploded, that there were investment grade securities that no one wanted. The municipal auction rate securities were a great example. You know, billions of dollars of those securities came back onto the balance sheet of the investment banks. No one's lost any money on those securities, but it was a liquidity problem at the time. I think, you know, there's a product that was sold for many years as a money market equivalent because it always had been, and then all of a sudden, when the credit markets froze, no one wanted to purchase an auction rate security.
Because of the uncertainty surrounding the risk assessments?
Because the remarketing agents had made the decision. I think they were, there was a, my recollection was that there was, every 7 days, there was an auction. And therefore, they could be put back to the broker-dealer and resold. And because of all else that was going on at the time, and the balance sheets of the investment banks were growing, they decided to call off the auction. And therefore, that put feature was no longer available. So there was a, you know, there was a lot going on at that period of time that was very, very temporary and was more about liquidity rather than credit quality.
Right.
Although the fact that the rating agencies got the ratings wrong on a lot of the debt, mm-hmm. and therefore the presumption that investment-grade securities would always be marketable was a good assumption for a long period of time, but we had a period in the market where not only were investment-grade securities not marketable, but the securities we thought were investment-grade really mm-hmm. weren't investment-grade.
So what are the options in responding to that from a regulatory perspective? I would just presume that the emphasis would be on trying to make to increase the transparency of the risk. But are there stronger approaches that you have taken? Or, I mean, we'll get to, I guess, the big legislation in a minute. But.
Well, the SEC has taken out the reference, mm-hmm. or is in the process of taking out the reference to NRSRO, Nationally Recognized Statistical Rating Organization, from their rules.
Mm-hmm.
So that broker-dealers need to make independent credit mm-hmm. decisions without relying on the rating agencies. Obviously, as you said, Dodd-Frank is mm-hmm. in reaction. We've done quite a bit of work with firms with respect to liquidity mm-hmm. and having dedicated liquidity at the broker-dealer to withstand stress events.
Mm-hmm.
The Basel capital initiatives are requiring each of the firms to have a larger capital base. We have added to our alert criteria a criteria for leverage,
mm-hmm.
Putting firms on heightened monitoring when their leverage exceeds a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a better understanding now of the composition of firms' inventory and their repo counterparties, concentration of repo counterparties and maturities.
Mm-hmm. Now, FINRA is created right around this same time. What can you tell me about that transition to the new organization? Is it severe, or was it a fairly outside of the mm-hmm. day-to-day work of harmonizing the rules and that sort of thing, a mm-hmm. Fairly natural process?
We were two regulatory organizations mm-hmm. with very similar missions, with staffs of people who were very committed to regulation and mm-hmm. doing the right thing for investors. So from that mm-hmm. perspective, it was an easy mm-hmm. transition because of the common mission.
Mm-hmm.
We spent quite a bit of time looking at the technology, looking at the way we do things, and trying to choose the best of both.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually now rolling out new examination technology that will really take us to a different level. It's been several years in the making, but will really move us to a risk-based program mm-hmm. that will allow the coordinators and examiners more flexibility in conducting their exams, will help the coordinators and examiners identify the risks that may be at the firms, and therefore be able to tailor the examination programs to those risks.
Mm-hmm.
there's been a lot of hard work by a large number of people.
Okay.
To get us where we are, which will hopefully by the end of this year we'll be there.
Mm-hmm. And coming back then to the legislation mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. Dodd-Frank, there's also the Jobs Act mm-hmm. as well. Obviously, at the SEC, the impact of that is quite steep. Is that reflected here at FINRA as well?
We have responsibility for funding portals.
Mm-hmm.
So there is work being done to look at what rules should apply to mm-hmm. funding portals. There's a process for them to become members mm-hmm. of FINRA. So there's been a tailored membership okay. process. I have not been involved directly
right.
in those discussions.
But one doesn't run into the same backlogs, for example, of rules that need to be made that one sees at the SEC?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
We certainly have, we certainly have work that needs to be done and mm-hmm. rules that are in various stages.
Mm-hmm.
We also have recently hired a chief economist
mm-hmm.
who will be responsible for conducting the economic analysis around each of the rules that we propose,
mm-hmm.
Which adds another layer of complexity to the rulemaking
right.
process.
Right.
So that means that it will take us longer to adopt new rules because we need to look at the cost-benefit relationship.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing, we were talking earlier about the group that came to the NYSE in 2004. It seems that that group has maintained a certain continuity. If you look at FINRA's senior leadership today, mm-hmm. a lot of those people are still around. Has mm-hmm. that been your sense that there's been actually a fairly extraordinary continuity from the perspective of, historical comparison?
Yeah, I think that that the senior team of people have mm-hmm. been, for the most part, consistent.
Mm-hmm.
I think people work well together
mm-hmm.
and, again, are passionate about regulation
mm-hmm.
and wanting to protect the investing public.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's to Rick's credit.
All right. Well, I guess that's about all the historical questions I have. I was noticing just in my research that the issue of the summer and it's been brewing for some time are the dark pools. Is that more of a market regulatory issue rather than member firm regulation?
That is more of a market
regulation issue. Yeah, I thought it might be.
We are all for transparency
mm-hmm.
in the markets. And I think having the dark pools does not
right.
Coincide with that. But I think if you do an interview with Tom Gira
right.
or John Militsis,
right.
you can hear all about dark pools.
All right. So then I guess I'll just return one last time then to the theme of women regulators.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could give me some general thoughts on trends that you may have seen over the course of your career. I mean, I think one could extract it from this
yeah.
interview, but
yeah.
just to summarize.
Well, I would say we've come a long way.
Uh-huh.
I think when I look back at when I started in the industry in 1977, there
mm-hmm.
were very few women
mm-hmm.
in senior positions. And I guess it's timely in that within the last week, I actually read the obituary of Muriel Siebert,
mm-hmm.
who was the first woman to hold a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. And I hadn't realized what she went through
mm-hmm.
as a woman, having to get that, being able to obtain that first seat on the New York Stock Exchange
mm-hmm.
and really paving the way for others. I think we've seen, we've certainly seen over the years. You know, I've continued in member regulation with a training class. Mm-hmm. So I started at the NASD in a training class in 1977. New York Stock Exchange began their first training class 26 years ago in mm-hmm. June. And we continued. I think there may have been one or two years when I was not here, mm-hmm. When the industry had financial problems that the exchange didn't hire trainees. But almost continuously, so 23, 24 out of the 26 years, we've had training programs of various sizes. And the number of women in those classes has, you know, continued to increase. Mm-hmm. We see a lot more
proportionally. Well, what roughly?
I would say it's probably 50%
yeah?
now.
Excellent.
So I think, you know, a lot of the issues that we faced early on mm-hmm. are really non-existent
yeah.
today. And I think maybe some of the opportunities that were afforded to me mm-hmm. result from organizations mm-hmm. wanting to elevate
making
women,
a concerted effort.
Making a concerted effort
yeah.
to promote qualified women to managerial positions.
Okay. Well, unless you have anything else you would like to add in, that's all I have.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.